Hi everyone, and welcome to Dungeon Casters, the Dungeon Master Advice Show for rookie DMs by rookie DMs.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben.
And we're here to help you make your campaign.
In 6 days or less.
And on the seventh day, we podcast. And it was good.
It was so good. It was so good. So this week, we're going to be talking about world building and all of the giant and tiny things contained within it. So my world building experience is, in my opinion, not amazing. I mean, my world building skills are not amazing, in my opinion. It's certainly what I would consider my biggest deficit in terms of DMing, the thing I consider the absolute hardest. Partially because it encompasses so much, partially because it's oftentimes very visual, and that's not something I do well, and it just requires a lot of time, and for lack of a better word, it's time I'm almost never willing to put in, and if I'm going to defend myself because I'm busy doing other parts of the campaign I find more interesting. Like I said in the last episode, have only really been running a full campaign for about 6 months, and I have tended to make the world as it's needed to appear for the players in the party, and that kind of means that I'm walking into white space most of the time and coloring it like Harold with a purple crayon as I go along. I know, Scott, that you have a much more hands-on and in-depth approach to world building than I do. I mean, I don't do like a lot of prep work on maps. I don't do a lot of prep work on, like, gods. And I want to amend this. I actually said in the last one that I don't use any of the wizard's canon for my games. But that's actually not true. I use the gods because they're very convenient for me to use. They're all there. They have relationships and domains and so on and so forth. And I find that much easier than building it all for myself. But you are somebody who likes to build everything all over every time.
So I'm a big fan of control. And when I can't get that through railroading, I get that through world building. And how I do that is I normally start like from the most basic. Like, I will create an entire Cosmere and planner system for a campaign, then a unique pantheon of gods for, you know, different domains relevant to what kind of theme I'm going for. Then I start drawing maps. I'll draw, like, really in-depth continents and countries and decide, are we doing it mostly in one kind of place or another kind of place? Is there a lot of water? Is there a lot of land? And then slowly from there, break it up into kingdoms and settlements and create political relationships between these already established kingdoms and, you know, drop, like, hundreds of, well, not hundreds, that's a little bit excessive, but drop massive amounts of NPCs into this world that, like, the players can find and interact with. And how it normally plays out is I put, like, close to 12 to 15 hours of work into this world building, and everyone looks at the map for 2 minutes and then ignores everything else. So it's really fun for me. I get a lot of joy out of it. And there are times where it does come up and it's super helpful to have, like, all right, they jumped on a boat and now we have to decide where they're going. Having this other country ready for them to jump into is really great and convenient. But other times it just sits there unknown and unexplored.
Yeah, we have pretty different styles of doing this. And it almost seems like the kind of world building that you, both of us stick to kind of has a lot to do with what problems am I willing to face and what problems am I not willing to face? So we're going to go through a couple topics here, starting with the fairly macro and moving into the more micro stuff. The first thing is magic, and that's something that has an enormous impact on the game, is an enormous feature of the game, and almost without magic, you can have Dungeons and Dragons without magic, but it almost looks like a different game completely. And so it's really important on the outset to know how much magic your world is going to have and to inform your players of that, because you can run really low magic campaigns and you can run zero magic campaigns and you can run extremely high magic campaigns where everybody is a spellcaster of some kind. And there's immensely powerful wizards and spellcasters in the world, and that is going to dramatically change the dynamic of everything. I mean, from the way your players interact with a person to the landscape of the world. Now, have you, what's the range of campaigns you've run with Magic as like a variable?
I have run, when I first started playing D&D, something that I've never, in fantasy and in role-playing games and video games, I've never been much of a caster. I've never enjoyed playing magical players.
That is such an understatement.
Alright, yeah, so I play a rogue every time.
Only
rogues, but like, but I like, they're variable, there's like kind of different kinds of rogues, but like, I play a rogue, that's what I play, that's what I enjoy, and so as a DM, I went into it not liking Magic when I first started DMing, and my first campaign, I just kind of ignored it as a world aspect and let the players use it if they wanted to. And then, as we mentioned last episode, there was the whole steampunk reskin debacle where I tried to eliminate Magic from the game, and that just doesn't work. And since then, I found ways to either, you know, have a high Magic campaign and enjoy it, and have low Magic campaigns. Like the current one I'm running, I have Magic. Magic's illegal in the world they currently live in, and aside from like very specific divine clerical magic from the theocracy that rules the land they're in. But other than that, like, all their magic is illegal. So there aren't magical items hanging around. Magic is not used in infrastructure or in, you know, everyday life. So it's the kind of thing that's, like, rare and impressive. And that makes the characters seem more unique for themselves, because a lot of them are spellcasters. They have, you know, this trait that not a lot of people they come in contact with are familiar with or see or, you know, used to. So it gives them a little bit of uniqueness. And it lets me satiate my desire to, like, hate on Magic. at the same time, I run really high Magic campaigns where, like, every rock a character turns over, there was some kind of Magic item under it. And that one's really fun, too.
Right, and I think that the Magic being so fundamental to how the game operates will really determine, again, kind of like world building in general and your style of it, kind of where you're going to deal with your difficulties. Because a high Magic campaign can be really, really fun, but also extremely dangerous mechanically. This was a problem that, like, 3.5 edition had, where everyone was basically a god, and unkillable,
yeah,
and almost immortal, and really troublesome. Everyone was so powerful, it was hard to give them a challenge. And in high Magic campaigns in general, you can probably equalize that with equally high-powered enemies, but it's worth noting that the players will always kind of be stronger than the game. As weird as that sometimes sounds, if you've ever played before, it seems like the game might be against them, but in high Magic campaigns especially, it really comes through because they're very smart, and they have group tactics, and they can form secret plans against you, and they're really very clever about how they use things, and that can become troublesome. It can be really fun.
Oh, it can be a great time.
But it can be really troublesome. And likewise, low Magic campaigns can be a lot of fun, but you'll deal with the difficulties of how do they even navigate this problem in a mundane way. Or if it's illegal, I mean, if they just get arrested outright, it's like, are we done now? It's a really, really big issue, and it has a huge amount of ramifications both aesthetically and mechanically.
Well, yeah, and I think that in regards to deciding when you're, you know, starting a campaign, if you want to do high Magic, low Magic, whatnot,
Just regular,
like, medium Magic.
Medium.
But, like, I think that it's important to look at your party, too, because if you're running a high Magic campaign or a low Magic campaign for the sake of the narrative, that's one thing, but if you don't really have a preference and you have an entirely martial party, maybe running a high Magic campaign would be fun because then they have, you know, the opportunity to get all these items and kind of explore Magic even as a, you know, non-magical fighter or a rogue or a barbarian or something like that. And then if you have a party full of spellcasters, maybe low Magic would be better because they already have that inherent Magic. They don't need it supplemented from the world.
Yeah, it's possible. And it's worth considering, too, whether it's the people that are magical or the world itself or both, because even from just a like a visual design element, if you have like a no magic world, you're going to get a lot of structures that you get in our world. You get a lot of brick, you get a lot of metal, you get a lot of stone, a lot of thatch, a lot of that kind of thing. In a magic a heavy world, you can get crazier structures with weird geometries, and that might be because people are making them that way, and it might also be because the world itself has magical qualities, you know, like reverse gravity sections, or just areas that float for other reasons, you know, gems that are inherently magical, water that flows in a different direction based on the day. I mean, all kinds of crazy things can happen without the players having to be a part of that, or NPCs having to be responsible. And that's going to influence it too, and it's an interesting thing to think about. What would it look like if the world itself was kind of doing it for you? It's just an idea, but it's something that can be fun and infuse that really high fantasy element without giving your players a lot of overpowered stuff.
Well, and that's the thing, is with the use of magic in the world, high magic doesn't necessarily mean there's a lot of magical items and spellcasters. As you said, it could just be a world that is, you know, innately full of magic. So, trees grow to ridiculous proportions because there's magic in the soil, yeah. And, you know, there's all these crazy natural events that happen due to the magic that's just infused.
Yeah, the weather.
The weather is another thing. And, like, you know, even an arcane-infused thunderstorm can have incredibly fun implications for a party in regards to either powering them up or creating a very interesting challenge for them. I think that when using magic like that, it's a great way to color your world. It's a great way to kind of let the players know they're not just, you know, playing in 1900 right. Europe right now. They're playing right. in an alternate, you know, plane of existence, or playing in another place that's more fun and more interesting.
Yeah, and another way to do that is with technology, which is, I don't want to say contentious, but I think there's kind of a divide. Whenever I see technology in campaigns, there seems to be like an absolute shitload of it, or none at all. and here, Scott and I, well, I wouldn't say very greatly, because you did do that steampunk campaign, but it feels like the technology that you have, if you're doing the steampunk thing, that's quite obviously been reskinned completely. But in your regular campaigns, where they're just D&D fantasy campaigns, in my experience, if I remember correctly, it was more traditional stuff. There wasn't a lot of, like, modern variants for fantasy worlds.
And that's the kind of thing that it has changed with my DM style over the years, and like, certain things have influenced me, and I know I haven't run, really, a campaign for you in
a
long...
while.
Yeah, it's been a long-ass time, ass. But, like, I recently... actually, Ben here showed me Terry Pratchett, and I started reading Terry Pratchett for the first time, and the concept that he uses of modern, not even technology, but kind of, like, ideas, colloquialism, and stuff like that, and having it in a fantasy setting is something that I found not only hilarious, but, like, super engaging and super fun. So I'm starting to try to do that in my campaigns, and having ideals that could not have existed in that fantasy world exist for the players, because then it allows them to dive into it a little more, because it's something familiar. It's something they can hold on to and kind of grasp from their regular life and pull into their fantasy character.
Right. And for those of you who may not know, Terry Pratchett he died only a few years ago, a really pretty genius, best-selling sort of satirical fantasy author. And his books, the Discworld series, are definitely worth checking out. And yesterday we mentioned materials that we use that are important to our idea generation and the worlds we make, and he was a big influence of mine. He's really my favorite author, not that that's original in the world at large, but I do love his work quite a lot. And so it's been influential in my making of my world, because I actually do use quite a bit of sort of modern technology adapted for a more archaic world. I mean there's cars, for lack of a better word. They're kind of like arcanely powered carts, but that's basically all a car really is. And there's you know, ships, like airships, that are going to have, there's a whole city that's much more modern than most fantasy cities. You know, they're made of metal, and they have, like, transmission capabilities, and there's parts, obviously, that I've put in that are more traditional. The town they were just in was far more traditional, mostly for being secluded from much of the world for a long time. But for me, infusing kind of funny and weird and unexpected, being the most important part, bits of technology into the world has made it more fascinating for me to write and hopefully more engaging for my players to play, or at least they can't anticipate necessarily what they're going to come up with next. And I think that's enjoyable for them on the whole. I hope so, anyway.
Yeah, no, I have a blast with it. I think it's great. And that's the thing with technology and also with magic. And both of these things kind of work together in your world building in a similar kind of function is the use and the, frequency that it's found and kind of like how common it is definitely affects the way your NPCs, even the less important, background character NPCs, will interact with the world. If you have a high technology world, you're not gonna have, as many farmers, out in the countryside. You're gonna have more textile based industry. If you have a large amount of magic, even if you do have those farmers out in the wild, they might have some kind of arcane implement that helps them farm and helps them become more successful. So it kind of can shape just the little things about your world that kind of make it unique in your own. When you are deciding this, though, it is important to stick to your guns, throughout the campaign.
Yeah.
Having, a lot of steam in the beginning and then running out towards the middle or end kind of sucks because not, as a, you failed as a DM, but just kind of, this was an interesting thing you had, and if you don't have it kind of planned and ingrained in your entire story, it falls off and it becomes irrelevant. And so it's important to, if you're making the active choice to have this a part of your world, to really embrace it, really pull it into all aspects of your world. Think about how, countries would interact with each other. Think about how NPCs would treat one another, how mercantilism and all that really, really, really fascinating stuff that everyone wants to simulate in their Dungeons & Dragons campaigns.
Oh, yes.
Would work when have a world full of magic or technology that is not from that era.
Yeah, things of that scale are going to be hugely influential in what everything looks like, and they're not to be taken lightly. And I think in terms of what I've thought about when it comes to world building, when I've thought at this scale, the dynamic between magic and technology has really been the biggest decision that has to get made. And I've done my best to combine them, not have one outweigh the other necessarily, because you can really kind of just replace modern sort of engines with arcane engines.
Yeah.
And lights with arcane. I mean, you can make magic kind of do anything you want, which is the really nice thing about it. But you do have to keep some level of continuity in there because your players will expect it. Mm-hmm. And if they really like it, you don't want to disappoint them by having it disappear.
Yeah.
So with that said, one of the more maybe traditional and I want to say influential, but it's something that doesn't come up often in my games, but I know is often more involved in your games, is like the pantheon of gods and religion and the forces beyond just magic that have a huge amount of sway over the world. Because they can be really, really big if you make them really big or your players make them really big, but they can equally fall to the wayside very soon and become almost irrelevant.
Well, and that stems from when I learned to play when I was first, starting to play D&D, and on 3.5, regardless of your class or your race or whatever, on your character sheet, there was a little space to put your deity. And I was, the person who taught me, they told me that everyone picks a god.
Well, it seems important. It has its own line on the character sheet.
And, the problem is when you're not a cleric or a paladin or, some kind of devout character, it just becomes like, this is the person I pray to if I find a shrine, or like, this is, instead of saying, god damn it, I'll say, Uthgar damn it. But other than that, it didn't come up much. And it was the kind of thing where I thought it was a very interesting kind of possibility for characters to have, this polytheistic religion that's beyond what it's ever been on, real Earth, in the sense that these gods do exist, and they interact, and
right.
People are divinely touched. There are paladins and clerics in the world that prove the existence of God because they have magic abilities granted directly by that God.
Right.
And so, I like to craft, you know, pantheons of gods for specific campaigns, and then give it to my characters while they're making their backstories. So they can be like, if any of these gods jump out at me, I can, you know, be an adherent of this god. And, I mean, it's not never necessary. There, I've had, you know, agnostic and atheist characters. I've had super-duper devout cleric paladin characters. I have, actually, in my current campaign, two characters that just by chance happened to pick the same god from my pantheon, and pretty early in the campaign witnessed the, you know, the big bad, the antagonist, kill their god right in front of them. And yikes. So, like, yeah, that has been a driving force behind them. So it can be used really excellently in your world if you have things like events where the gods are relevant, where the gods are connected. Or, like, at the end of the day, again, I've said it once, I'll say it again, I'm a fan of railroading when it needs to be done, and, like, a direct mission from God is a great way to get your characters to do something.
That's the plot of the Blues Brothers, my dude.
Like, there you go.
And that's a great movie.
It is a great movie.
But yeah, I mean, this is one of those things, especially when you're on this level of planning, that this process can be so intensely time-consuming if you let it become that. And even when you work really hard to not let it become, it's still really time-consuming.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have to pick your battles. I mean, if you want a story that's centered around magic and its place, is it there, is it not, is it too much, what's going on with that, focus on that part. If it's technology you want to talk about, focus on that part. Have these other pieces, but focus on that part. If you want a gods-based story, do the work there. Don't do the work there and on technology and on magic. Because if your story is all centered around one of these pieces, will they interact with each other? Yeah. But you'll want to know most about the thing your players are going to interact with the most.
So yeah, keep your focus when you are world building, when you are planning, on what's most relevant to the narrative you're thinking it's going to go. That being said, having a little bit for everything is good, because sure, your characters will never go along with the narrative you initially set out.
They'll want to know something you didn't think about.
Always.
And this was something Scott and I have been talking about before, that there's issues that arise with any style of doing world building, and for what it's worth, any style of really doing anything. What are some of the problems that you encounter in the style that you use, which is very in-depth, very homebrewed, very, very meticulous?
Couple things is I overestimate how dedicated I will be in the future towards these things. So I will, you know, start out, I'll make maps, I'll do the relevant bits and pieces for that first session, and then just be like, oh, well, I'll fill in the rest of the pantheon and the rest of the maps as we go along and as I get to them. And then it never happens. So I start these campaigns with these, like, really richly detailed maps that are great, and then by the time the characters get to the next region, they're just like, where's the map? And I don't have one anymore. So, I run out of time a lot. Also, as I mentioned before, a lot of it never even gets found, touched, or used.
Yeah.
That being said, it's a labor of love. It's something that I honestly enjoy doing, so I will not stop.
You would do it
anyway. Yeah, I would just do it for fun, even if I wasn't, you know, DM.
Right.
It's the kind of thing that, like, as a huge nerd, it is something that fascinates me to no end, to be able to draw these maps and create these worlds. So it's something I do just for fun. In addition, the only other problem I really get into is when I go too big. Because, as Ben mentioned, I like to get really, really into the details, and sometimes I will go too far. And when that happens, I'll run into problems like I am with my current campaign, where I've planned too much and tried to cram it too much information into this, you know, very specific campaign. And so I'm having to edit out and kind of, like, hybrid everything so it's all still relevant. And I gave them, like, three diverging narratives.
Oh my
and, like,
God.
Now I have to, like, it's impossible to maintain that.
Yeah.
So what's ending up happening is they're following one, and the other ones are kind of like, oh yeah, and that thing is happening too. But, like, all of the ideas and work I had for those, like, they're getting nixed. It's being removed because, like, we just don't have the time. We campaign once a week over webcam and normally for, like, 2 hours because, you know, people got jobs and they gotta work and stuff. So we don't have that much time to play every week. So it kind of ends up being, like, all right, I had all these cool ideas that I could have used, but it was, like, 3 separate campaigns that I was trying to run at the same time. Right. So I got, with my massive amounts of planning, I just over-planned to the point where I shot myself in the foot.
Right. Sort of conversely, I have an issue in that I tend to, I wouldn't say under-plan, but I don't plan nearly as much. I work in broad strokes and improvise a great deal of what I say. The reason is we play with a really large party. We have like 6 players, upwards of 7 sometimes. You've recently for a birthday party DM'd like 10.
Yeah, there were 10 of us.
There was 10.
That was rough.
But our core group for the campaign I've been running for the last 6 months or so is about 6. And while that is challenging in certain ways, it's nice that often everything takes so long. Just in terms of like conversations about what we're going to do next, where we're going to go and why, that it's not even really worth it for me to plan out that much in advance because we'll never get there. It takes so long that I can just let it luxuriate in itself, and that's really nice. And I get to react in pretty sort of leisurely time because everyone spent like an hour discussing what to do.
To put this in perspective for you folks out there, Ben's, you know, we've had 6 sessions or so in Ben's campaign. Most of them have been close to, like, 8-hour sessions.
Yeah.
And
at least 6, and, like, at least 6.5 hours each.
We spent 3 sessions on the intro boat that was supposed to take an hour.
It was supposed to take
and
time.
we just got really distracted on a boat.
Yeah.
And then we spent the last,
I think, like 4. While.
I think my math is wrong now about the amount of times we played. But, like, the last, like, 4 sessions were in this town where it was, I mean, it was, like, a moral gray area. There was a lot to it. But, like, we could not agree. We could not decide. So, like, not that we were at each other's throats. But there was, like, a lot of discussion. There was, like, you know, probably 3 hours of play to 5 hours of discussion for every session as to what we're going to do, why we would or wouldn't do that, and, like, the kind of, like, consequences we might not want to deal with. And instead of just acting, we kind of ad nauseum talked it out.
There was a lot of rumination about it. But so for me, especially the more I've sat with the party and knowing that it takes this long, I've said, well, there's really not much point in me planning out a million things in advance because you guys never get anywhere that quickly. So it was fine. However, in campaigns other than this, and even in this from time to time, it comes up that there's just, somebody wants to know something. You know, what's the name of the country we're in? And I say, shit, I have no idea. And so, in this particular case, I just said Guam, and Scott lovingly made me a map of fantasy Guam. But it was moments like that where I said, I don't even remember the country's name. And when they asked me, you know, which cardinal direction is this town from this town, I said, I don't know, east? And when I looked at what I had said, I said, it can't be there. Like, it physically can't be there. And I've had to constantly kind of rewrite what this looked like, and they've been very patient about it, and it hasn't been an enormous issue, but almost every turn, when it comes to wider scale questions about geography and the spread of things, I have to make it up on the spot. And while I'm not super uncomfortable with that, it means that I don't have any hard copy version of that unless I have the mind to write it down exactly in that moment, which I'm usually too busy to do in that moment. Thankfully, Scott is a very good note taker for me, but even so, it means I run into these walls all the time where I say, I don't even remember where this was in relation to this other thing. Like, I have no idea what's beyond this mountain range. I have no clue. And if at a moment's notice they said, we want to go, I'd have to go, okay, I guess we're going to make it up as we go along and hope that it makes sense. And that is a real improv problem. It's a real sort of quickness of mind problem. If that's not something you're worried about, do do that. You know, I mean, but if you can meet somewhere in the middle of the two of us, that's going to work too.
Probably
if you want to plan like Scott does, do that. It's there's always going to be some level of flaw in the system. There's always going to be something you can't prepare for, mostly because between the die rolls giving you a lot of random results and your players just having interests you can't anticipate, you have to just go, I don't know, and I have to know right now. And whatever that means, I have to write it in, or I have to change it. And that's just kind of the nature of the game overall. But when it comes to more of the in-depth planning, you do maps.
I do maps.
I do maps.
A lot of maps. Sometimes I do maps for campaigns I haven't even started yet, or created, or thought of.
How do you create them?
My main rule of thumb is I am a subpar artist, so what I'm able to do is draw them by hand myself. I normally start with a real country that has an interesting shape and trace it onto a piece of paper, or, you know, freehand draw it onto a piece of paper, and then just squiggle around the lines and mix it up and take away, you know, country borders and stuff like that until it looks like the world I want my players to be in. And then I start populating it. I normally try to have a pretty various climates where I'll have a desert area, I'll have a jungle area, I'll have a mountainous area. I normally tend to gravitate towards warmer climates in general for my campaigns, just because that's what, as a person, I prefer warmer. I don't like the cold. So I don't do a lot of, like, snowy tundras. I don't do a lot of high mountain peaks. I do a lot of jungles over, you know, forests. I do a lot of deserts and, like, hills and plains and stuff like that. But I kind of just populate the world in a way that makes sense to me with the terrain, and then I start drawing in, you know, country borders and kind of nations, and that bit is, it comes a little bit easier once you have the terrain in there, because you think about it, in the real world, country borders and state borders, or, you know, borders in general, are normally made on natural landmarks. So if you put a river through the middle of your country, or the middle of your continent, and you have two countries, that river is probably the dividing line.
Probably, yeah.
So you can use kind of the terrain you build and what's important to, you know, kind of divide your world up. I will say that one thing that's important to think about is where your characters are going to need to go on this map and how they're going to get there. Because if you have two towns across this entire continent that they have to go back and forth from, and there's no waterway to get there quickly, they're going to have months and months and months of walking or riding or hanging out wagons or whatever, getting between these places or whatnot, and it's going to really pump the brakes on your narrative.
Right. Agony is not as fun as people say it is. that's an important lesson, is that, yeah, I mean, difficulty in traveling somewhere can make it more exciting, in that, like, oh, geez, we gotta go up this enormous mountain. This is gonna take forever, and we have, like, a timeline. It's like, that's a hurdle. I mean, that's a basic narrative hurdle that can really function, but it's also like, holy shit, this sucks. Like, this is terrible. I don't want to do this. And you know, like Scott said, if you can think of a way, say, ah, there's a waterway. Maybe it's dangerous, but you can guarantee this time. That's at least a nice option to have. And I think that that's an important thing, too, is when you're going to make these maps, the diversity of landscape can be fun if it's something you're willing to do. You have to accommodate for that, too, because if you put in tundras and you put in deserts, I mean, then you're really going to have to start talking about, like, how does the body handle being in a desert for 6 weeks, which is rough. And if you don't want to do that, you can skip it narratively and say, you know,
Everything's temperate.
Or at least, you know, you stay within the confines of a certain continent that's temperate. And I mean, do you do multiple continents when you map make, or do you stick with, like, more countries within a continent?
I normally do a single, continent.
Right.
I don't like the idea of using massive sea travel mid-campaign unless a resolution has been reached.
Okay.
So if I'm in a country and my campaign has reached its resolution, they've, you know, defeated the big bad, they've completed their quest, and now they're like, all right, well, what do we do now? That's when I'll chuck them on a boat, and you guys are going to cross this ocean. Because the idea is, like, seafaring, regardless of, you know, how much tech or magic you put in your world, is a dangerous endeavor. And these massive month-long journeys from continent to continent would not be the kind of thing a party would do mid-quest.
Right.
In my, you know, in my thinking. So I save a second continent for the second quest line, or if we want to revisit characters and, you know, kind of re-dive into a world. But mostly I stick to one continent, especially because the idea that in the D&D world there are lots of heroes. It's not just your characters. Well, it could be if that's what you write, but normally it's not just your characters. There are other people that are heroic, so that continent's going to have a party of, you know, people going around fighting evil liches as well. So I don't feel
at
like...
At least one.
At least one. So, like, yeah, I don't feel like you need to have multiple continents. If you want it, and if that's important for your narrative, I think it's a great idea, and it's more than I do, which is actually really saying something. So, like, go for it if that's what floats your boat, but in the way I see it, it doesn't make sense for a single story narrative. If you're going to continue beyond that initial quest, that's when I think a second continent comes
in. Yeah, again, it comes back, I think, to relevance. Like, if you think, like you said, having that second, third, fourth continent available is super important. If it's like a political issue, if you're having a very political campaign, which is totally doable within the game, then having a lot of powers to interact with might be the whole crux of the game. You know, maybe this is like, can we prevent this giant world war? Can we make peace between these three countries where there is none? That can be really, really effective in that case. But if you're running a campaign that's like, can we save this kingdom? Four continents you will never see is probably way more effort than you will ever need to put into this. And it's just, for lack of a better term, kind of a waste of your time. And also you have to consider just real-world thinking. Traveling to another continent, even now, is not the easiest thing in the world. I mean, you still have to get on a plane for like 26 hours to get to Australia. I mean, if you had to do this on foot, your players will be 35.
Yeah.
I mean, you really have to consider that maybe it's exciting and maybe, oh, this is like the place where the desert is and this is like a tundra continent, which is fun and you want them to go there and it would be cool to see different landscapes. But it may be worth putting it in the same continent just so there's a possibility they can actually reach it.
And even if not, even if you disagree with everything we just said, as we were talking before about magic is your ultimate tool as a GM to just be like, hey, alright, so yeah, these continents are far apart. Maybe you are doing that political prevent the world war campaign and you have to jump continents. Looks like there's a teleportation circle network set up across the entire globe.
Yeah.
Alright, so now
wouldn't that be
all those problems we thought about with travel are gone because you just teleport.
Right.
So, and that's a wonderful thing about magic in D&D is that whenever you, you know, write yourself into a wall as a DM, you just be like, well, it's magic.
It's magic!
It's a cop-out. It's very much a cop-out. And, players will, 9 times out of 10, call you out on your bullshit with that. But you can still just answer, it's magic.
It is a shovel in a hole. It gets you out of anything. Not cleanly, but it'll get you out.
It certainly will.
And so, things like that are something to consider. Is the point to have all this space, or is it just something that I want to do because I think it would be cool? And oftentimes it being cool is a good reason to make it, but not necessarily a good reason to apply it. But when you get smaller than countries, you move into kingdoms, towns, settlements, that's where you, I think, in my opinion, have less leeway on leaving in or taking things out. These things really have to exist. And there's going to be a lot of them. And they're going to be close enough together that you have to make a bunch unless you have a very specifically isolated kingdom or something. You know, they've made it a point to be a million miles away from everything else, but that's kind of unnatural. And you'd have to kind of craft a story around why this place is so secluded.
And if you're not crafting that specific seclusion story, there's a lot of implications in regards to country relations, national relationships, and Also, you look at the cultural makeup of your world, which is super important, and a lot of people, not in any bad way, but D&D canon has established a cultural identity for all the races, a cultural makeup of the different, you know, kind of areas of the world and that kind of stuff, and most players are at least versed enough in fantasy where you can fall into those tropes and not address them if they're not relevant.
Right.
Like, even if it's not the D&D canon specifically, most people who are going to be playing Dungeons & Dragons with you will know what a dwarf acts like versus what an elf acts like versus what an orc acts like.
They'll probably know something. I mean, even people who don't hang around fantasy very much, that sort of Tolkien-esque stuff is so ingrained into at least, you know, UK American culture now that you get enough of a sense that you don't need to know everything. But that stuff is that's low level stuff in terms of, like, it's ground level, but it's really critical, and it will shape a lot politically and racially. What is even sometimes acceptable for your characters to play.
And that being said, I think that it's, if you are choosing to use it, it can be one of the coolest and most interesting parts of your campaign.
Sure.
One of the things I love to do in my campaign is be subversive of those fantasy tropes and have the dwarves be, you know, not stout and hardy, but more artful, and have the elves be less, you know, willowy and pretentious and be more warlike, and have the orcs be very, you know,
scholarly
and zen, or however you want to do it. And, like, very so zen. Taking those tropes those characters have learned to depend on and kind of altering them to make them kind of readjust to a new world is a lot of fun. And one of the ones I do, we mentioned gods before and pantheon stuff, and but we didn't really mention the human side of the pantheon, the churches and the worshippers. And that is something that I use a lot in my campaigns as, I think it's important to paint a moral gray area. I think it's important to not let your characters fall into the, we are good, they are evil tropes. So I use a lot of things that are normally established and understood as good institutions as evil institutions, as the bad guys. And so that way, you don't know if you should support or, you know, fight against these organizations. You don't know if they're helping or hurting. And that way, there is no easy answers for your players, which creates, you know, tension and drama, which is really important for a fun campaign.
It's super duper important. And I think that this is the stuff, this culture stuff, that is really my area of interest. I tend to focus more on these, like, single party relationships and these small time interactions that have larger implications than anything else. I mean, in our campaign, it was really just a matter of, like, I don't know, like 5 or 6 people who had engaged in a pretty savage little war amongst themselves that had caused, like, this huge amount of strife for a town. And we can get into, like, the nitty-gritty of my campaign and what I did and how I planned it in a later episode about narrative structures and stuff like that. But these are the little things, you know, are they warlike? Are they afraid all the time? Why are they afraid all the time? And what does that mean for the way people speak? I mean, even word usage is a part of world building. Are they, you know, how many polysyllabic words do they use? I mean, is it like a very, very uppity place? Is it really, really low? Is it in strife? Is it falling apart? You know, is it petty? I mean, there's all these little things that really matter. And they're, to me, the coolest thing to think about and the stuff I have the most fun working on. And I think probably where my particular DMing shines the most is in these little contingent stories, not contingent, little sort of self-contained stories that lead to sort of more expansive results. And they're all culture-based. It's like you look at the Monster Manual especially and you say, like, all right, well, this thing is evil, or it's at least not good, and this thing is good, and they're in conflict, and they have this ideological difference. And it's like, well, they fight, but when two strong things fight, there's fallout. And sometimes the fallout's the really interesting part, because you walk into the fallout, and now you're stuck in the fallout. And now it's like, do you fix it? Do you leave? And that has implications. And you say, how far does this stretch out? And that's your world. Especially when it comes to the players, you know, you start up the engine. But after that, the wake they leave behind will serve you 100 times in what's going to come back and what the world ends up looking like afterwards. Did you save the town? Did you not save the town? Because you didn't save the town, what happened in that area? That's all huge. And I want to just step back for a moment onto something a little bigger about, like, kingdoms and structures and more physical elements.
Sure, sure.
And also on kind of references that we use. I recently started watching a Netflix documentary series, the name which I can't remember, but it's the only one on Irish castles. So if you want to find it, it's on Netflix. It's on Instant Watch. It's Irish castles. It's an Irish production. It's about the history of Ireland and where all its castles came from. And it's really fascinating because you kind of learn that all these castles were built by a bunch of knights who'd been thrown over into Ireland to take Ireland for the King of England at the time. And once they were there and they realized the king really didn't have eyes on them all the time, they were kind of land-grabbing and petty and, like, fighting each other all the time and having these stupid little civil wars. And so that kind of stuff is cool. I mean, you know, you walk into a town or a city, or a country in this case, and you see, wow, it's covered in castles. It must be like a very warlike thing, and it must be really wealthy, and like, holy crap, look at all this. And then you find out, like, it's a bunch of, like, expat knights who are just, like, pissed at each other and, like, don't take my acreage. Like, you stay over on your side. And it's, like, really, it's almost kind of funny how small that is. But that's, like, that's a culture piece that's grown into an infrastructure piece that is also part of the basic culture of a space. And it's like, it's so human and it's so tiny. Like, it's just like, don't you stay on your side, I'll stay on my side. But it's huge in its impact.
And that's the thing, is like, that is your job as the DM to craft that world, right? And then let your characters do what they will. Because mm-hmm. with that, you know, petty land grabby expat knight situation.
Oh boy.
Like,
so much drama.
There's so many options. You mm-hmm. know, your players can try to create peace. They can join one side versus the other. They yeah. can fight them all.
Yeah.
They can ignore it completely yeah. and go about their business.
They can start a war and leave.
Exactly. And, you know, sometimes parties will do that.
A lot of times parties will do that.
And the other great thing is, like, I've been talking about the campaign I'm running and how magic's illegal. Like, there's a lot of nuance like that in the culture of my world that I didn't inform the players of before we started purposely, because they are new to this area. They actually just recently discovered they don't even remember how they got to this country or what they're doing here. They just kind of got dropped in, and there's some divine influence there. But right in the beginning, they were walking past a couple, you know, members of the clergy that were hanging a woman who was accused of being a witch. And 3 out of 4 of the party members were just like, all right, not our business, keep going. But my, you know, paladin, the trusty paladin, always a force for good, was just like, no, they're being mean to that lady, we have to help her. And he went over and he killed all 3 of the clerics and save that woman.
Oh.
And so, it just so happens that the, you know, she did have a trial, and she was accused of being a witch, and she was technically a witch, and so the church was, you know, within their rights, so they sent an entire battalion of Templars to level the settlement. Mm. And, you know, then the party has these cultural implications and this cultural knowledge they didn't have, and they now learned, now they have to deal with it. So they had to relocate a 3,000 person populace somewhere else so they wouldn't all be killed.
That's an enormous undertaking. I don't even know how I'd go about doing it.
It was actually, they handled it quite well.
Okay.
They did a great job, and I'm super proud of all of them. But, like, it's the kind of thing where I love, not in a malicious way, but I love fucking with my players.
Sure.
I love...
You have to. That's the game.
It's fun to, like, alright, I've created this character, and this is what he believes, and then my DM is going to take everything my character believes and turn it on its head.
Yeah.
And now I have to develop as a character, and I have to problem solve, and I have to, you know, make peace with how the world is treating my views.
Right.
And I think that is a wonderful thing to do to a person, because it makes you actually roleplay. Instead of, you know, this is the math on my character sheet, it makes you like, well, this is the person I'm playing, and this is how they feel about this. How are they gonna deal with this.
Right, and because the crux of the game, in a lot of ways, is just adventuring, which by nature is leaving where you were to go somewhere else. If your world isn't causing your players some kind of moral strife, some kind of ethical dilemma, then in my opinion, you're being sort of too easy on them, and you're misrepresenting a world. It shouldn't meet them halfway. You know, it really is going to be what it is, regardless of what they think. And it's their job and their part of the game to deal with that. And that's where the character development is going to come in. That world stuff is so important. It's the counterpoint to the backstories, which in the last episode we really praised. It's saying, like, here's where I come from. This is what I believe now. And when they go off into the world and see things they've never seen and talk to people they never knew existed, how's that going to change? And if it doesn't change, then really all you've made is a carbon copy of where they were with no path to change. And that's, it's dull from a character perspective. And your world is the thing that turns for, not for them, turns almost against them.
Yeah.
Or they turn for it, is maybe another way to think about it. And I think the last thing I just want to say about that point is, or at least all these points, actually, I should say, is more that I think understanding will do you more good than knowledge, if that makes sense.
I'll explain that a little bit for me.
Yeah. So, for me, I don't remember information very well. Like, that's just the thing. I don't remember information very well. When I make stuff, even, I'm like, I don't remember what the hell I said. And so, you know, having a million pages of information and having all these things ready and having to know said information doesn't really work for me, as it may not work for you. And you may not agree with this at all. But understanding of how the world functions and what the parameters are, at least at a basic level, lets me say, well, I don't know, but I know that this isn't a thing. And I know that in most cases, this happens. And I know that I want it to be hostile in this way. And I know that I want it to be comforting, or at least the world is almost an ally in this way. You know, I don't know how this particular person would react to seeing a half-orc, but I know that the world at large doesn't care. So is that different or is that the same? That's really the only the distinction I have to make. Is this different or the same than the general parameters that I want to work with? You know, because I put in technology, you know, sort of magic-fueled technology, and even in some cases just technology, science-fueled technology.
Yeah.
Do I say that's everywhere? Well, no. In the town you were just in, it's not there. And all I had to say was, it's weird because it's everywhere else. It doesn't really matter why exactly. It doesn't matter in every which way. It doesn't even matter sometimes what people have left the town, who's seen it. Just knowing that this is weird in the world at large. Maybe somebody's seen it outside, maybe somebody hasn't. It's, for me, it's an understanding of the world's premise. It's not a knowledge of the world's details that's helpful to me.
Well, yeah, and that definitely makes sense. And you know, you mentioned having the changes be, you know, more in the moment and relevant to, you know, the current settlement.
Oh, yeah.
The town we were in didn't have all this technology because they were isolated. And that was a good reason for it. But, you know, it's the kind of thing where you can, you know, build that however specifically or non-specifically you want.
Oh, absolutely.
But it is important to, when you're looking at things like settlements that have differentiation from the rest of your world or whatnot, why?
Yeah.
Like, every time you bring the party to a town, the first thing you have to remember is this town needs a purpose. It's like it's like that whole, Chekhov's gun situation. Like, if you bring them to a settlement, it needs to have a purpose in your story.
Yeah.
And you should build your town around that purpose. Now, if your party literally just needed a place to stop for the night, maybe you can just throw an inn on the side of the road. If you want a whole town for that, that's fine, but then it would probably be like a boring, sleepy town with nothing going on.
Yeah.
And they'd go to the inn, have dinner, go to sleep, wake up next day and leave. If they are looking for criminal contacts, you probably have to build a settlement with a seedy underbelly.
Yeah.
It's because that's the relevant part. But at the same time, if they are just going to the city to meet the criminal underworld, it's not really necessary for you to build the entire, you know, merchants guild and tradesmen, you know, center of the city, because they're not going to be directly influenced. And, you know, right. knowing that they exist and they're there can be helpful, but the part of the city that's relevant is the part that you should focus on and the part that you should really, you know, understand. So when you're designing these settlements, when you're building these places for your characters to go, it's important to think about the purpose on what, you know, that purpose, what kind of settlement would have the answer to their question.
Yeah, what they're even interested in doing there. Why they're going in the first place. And like you said, if it's just, we just need a place to sleep. I wouldn't even bother describing that town. I'd say you find a town, I make up a name on the spot, you pay this much at the inn, and in the morning you leave. You know, it doesn't have to be something you set out. You don't have to force it. And if you're saying it's just a transition point between here and there, well, fine, that's all it is. That's all right, as long as it's fast. You know, if it's just there to sleep, do they need to get robbed? I don't know. Do they need to get into, like, a big fracas? I guess if they start one.
Yeah.
But otherwise,
you leave it in their hands.
Let the important and the interesting and the more relevant parts of the world shine. And anything else can be a sort of small-time transitory little spot, like a little hub. Is there anything else you wanted to say before we...
Well, I mean, with that, I do think that the one other thing that's important for, in regards to settlements and building, and I'm going to, you know, say this pretty quick because we're running close to that hour mark, is establishing groups of people and organizations.
Yeah, sure.
Because they can be the most useful narrative tools, in addition to, like, NPCs, which we will get into in a later episode.
Yeah, absolutely.
The idea of courts of nobles, tradesmen guilds, arcane universities, bardic colleges, in the case of Ben's campaign, the Men in Black clone known as the Fae in
Grey. The Fig.
And, like, all sorts of different things like that. Give your characters, you know, these societies to be a part of, which is awesome, because the idea that, you know, the character can join this group or, you know, be antagonistic with this group creates a whole new dynamic and a whole new kind of aspect of your world where this organization exists in multiple places across the world, and it's, you know, affects the way it works.
Yeah, they're doing stuff, and that's something, again, to keep it short, to remember that if you have little pieces you want to inject throughout that are going to interact later, or you just want to remind them they're there, use them. I mean, you're right. There's other people, you know, there's not, but there are. There's organizations, and they have motivations. And so if they get robbed, then it's the guild, like, damn that guild again. They keep taking my stuff. And then if the party wants to pursue that, you got a whole adventure hook there, and you got a whole world to build of what it looks like in the sewers and what it looks like in this settlement where they live, and all these kind of interesting things that will lead you through. Without you really having to even consider what you'll need, you'll know right at the outset. Like, they want to go here, you're going to the bad city. You're going to Scary Time City, and if you're going to the sewers, a Scary Time City.
Yeah.
So, if you have any questions about worlds you're building, struggles you're having, feel free to ask us any questions. Email us at dungeoncasterpodcast@gmail.com.
Or tweet us at dungeon_casters.
And maybe we'll answer your questions in an episode.
Hey, Ben.
Uh-huh.
Hey, Ben.
Yes.
Hey, Ben.
I'm here.
Did you hear the one about the broken spear?
I wish I could say yes, but I haven't.
Yeah, that joke doesn't really have any point. In this podcast, we used Achilles and News Sting by Kevin MacLeod of Accompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons.